be elsewhere.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3128. We'll hear from staff. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3128 authorizes the State Board of Education to take into consideration certain characteristics of a school district in establishing a matching variable rate of grants or loans, for capital costs of school districts financed with Article 11P bonds. The characteristics include the school district's value of property that is subject to levy, the tax rates of the district, and the district's relative ability to finance infrastructure without matching state funds. The matching rate for state to local funds for a school district may not exceed 9-1. And that's a short summary of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Chair Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative from House District 11, and I want to tell you a little bit about how the unusual event occurred that I ended up sponsoring a bill that ended up in this committee, because I generally decline to do that, even if there are bills that are important to me. I expected this bill to go to the Committee on Education, which it did, and I wasn't at all sure that it was going to come back to us, because it is an issue involving state finance that we typically do deal with. I attended a meeting of the superintendents in Lane County that was hosted by the superintendent of Lane ESD at their office in Northwest Eugene in November, although it may have been a little later than that, in which there was it was a very well attended meeting. Lane County, as is true for many counties, has a few very large districts. Eugene, 17,000 students, rough numbers. Springfield, around 11. Bethel, I think 8,000 or 9,000. But it also has a bunch of very small districts. In my legislative district, there's Marcola. Central Lynn is a bit bigger. Crestwell is a bit bigger yet. And then I have pieces of many other districts. But there were several issues that came up. One of them had to do with repair and replacing school buildings. Many of these districts, and there's some superintendents behind me who are going to talk about some of the specifics of their districts, so I'm not going to steal their thunder. But I would simply note that in many districts, we're dealing with a paucity of real property value per student, which is one of the bases upon which it's possible to raise money. And a very old school building, and notice I didn't use the plural, because small districts only have one, or at least only one campus, and the need to either replace or extensively remodel, and the absolute inability to raise the money to do it. I would like you to do a little thought game in your own minds, and think about what would happen. What would be the capacity of the districts, except for Representative Benz, and everyone else I think has some larger districts in their district, a larger number of students district. What would happen in your legislative district if the largest school district there suddenly found itself in a position of needing to replace all of its buildings or extensively repair them? I think even the wealthiest districts in our state would be hard-pressed, and any other districts would find it impossible. That is precisely the situation that the tiny districts find themselves in. The point of this bill is to allow the department to establish rules and to make decisions that would take into account the size of the district, the relative wealth of the district, its capacity to actually pay for these kinds of things. And the reason I say size, even though it's not in the bill, it is in the general clause at the end of the modification. is precisely because of the issue I've just raised. If Eugene needs to replace a building, they're dealing with 40 buildings plus. So we're talking about 2.5% of their structures. In Portland, of course, it's an even better number than that. It is possible for them to do that. It can be done without any assistance from the state. But we have children who are going to school in buildings that I wouldn't want any of my grandchildren to even enter. But that is what is happening in those buildings. Kids are going there trying to learn with the leaks or roofs leaking, the heating system not working, and the floors collapsing under their feet. We need to do something useful to help those districts deal with this problem. This is one possible solution. I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, Representative. Would they therefore set different rates based on, like, would it be like a change in their risk assessment? So they would, like, the larger districts with more assets and whatever would get better rates, and the smaller ones would get worse ones, or am I not?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Smith Warner. The point of this, I think, is the opposite of that. First, let me say that the treasurer won't, the district is not supposed to sell bonds if it can't pay them back. So the risk shouldn't be an issue. Hopefully, when we deal with all of this, the risks are going to be similar across districts. I think the point of it is to allow poor small districts that have to replace a high percentage of their dilapidated buildings an opportunity to raise a smaller amount of money. They would still need to raise some. And, of course, that would still mean going out for a levy for most of them in order to do it. But imagine running a levy, a levy election in a place with a really dilapidated building and saying the state will give us three times as much money as we have to come up with if you pass this levy. So for every dollar in extra property taxes you have to pay, the state will pay $3 to help us get this building built. Now, of course, the way we would finance it would be through general obligation bonds under the constitutional
11P,
the subsection 11P. We can borrow $50,000 except for all these exceptions, and this one's P. And, of course, it would have to go through the Ways and Means process. It would have to go through the process in which the Capital Construction Committee that works on the bonding budget, and then the House and Senate would have to approve it. So this bill is only part of the story. It would allow the department, however, to recommend this arrangement for a particular levy.
May I follow up briefly?
Follow up.
Thank you. So it's more being able to set varying levels of match just to
thank you.
More than it's not the rate, it's not the way I was thinking of it, the district serving in kind of the banking capacity and ranking them based on, but instead it's kind of allowing them to set varying match levels between the district and what what the state will then match. Is that more what this is like? Yeah. Not exactly, but okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
you. That clarifies
Representative Smith Warner.
Very much.
That's exactly what I contemplated in drafting the bill, was that we were talking about the percentage of the money that the locals would come up with versus the amount that the state would come up with, and have the department, the board, actually figure out what that ought to be. As I said, it still has to go through the Ways and Means process and the legislative approval process in order to actually do it, because otherwise you don't have authorization to sell the bond.
Be able to differentiate it
right
between different sizes of districts and different
right
resource levels. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to have Brian Reeder. Come up. Welcome.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vega Peterson, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Brian Reeder with the Research Office at the Department of Education. As you may know, there was a task force over the interim called the Task Force on School Capital Improvement Planning that addressed this very question, Article 11P bonds, with the state offering matching funds to school districts. During that process, one issue that came up is whether a match rate of state to local dollars that's greater than one is actually constitutional or not. And I think that's still an open question. It's not addressed in Article 11P, but it is addressed in Article 11G. So that's an open question, I think, at this point. The task force did recognize that providing a higher match rate to districts that have a higher need was important in order to generate a strong enough incentive for local districts to be able to actually pass a bond, to go to their voters and say, for every dollar that we raise, the state's going to kick in this extra amount of money. And we saw in a federal program during the worst part of the recession, called the Qualified School Construction Bond Program, that that program essentially paid the interest on bonds that school districts could issue. And what we saw is that we think it did encourage certain districts who in the past had not been able to pass a bond levy were able to do that. I think NISA is an example, NISA or Ontario. I believe Ontario, now that I think back, had gone for decades without passing a bond, but with this interest subsidy, they were able to pass one a few years ago. So the point is, provide some money to leverage local money. So the issue here that I think is unclear, as I said, is what the highest match rate is. The task force operated under the assumption that it was 1-to-1, that it could be not greater than 1-to-1. So it developed a formula where the match rates depended on two factors. The first was the one that Representative Barnhart mentioned, and that was assessed value per student, which is a measure of the ability of a district to raise money. And then the other factor was the level of poverty in the district. And in that measure, we use the same one that the department uses in the school funding formula. It's a census-based census data that determines or estimates the percentage of students within the district that live in poverty. So what we observe out there in Oregon school district is there are districts where the population is relatively low income, even though the district itself may have a lot of property value per student. A great example, I think, is Seaside. They've got a lot of second homes and commercial property, but the population that lives there is relatively moderate to low income. So they have a need in terms of being able to afford a bond levy among their residents. But on the other hand, the tax rate needed to raise that money wouldn't be as high as it would be in another district that had less property value per student. So the task force developed a variable rate, a variable match rate that varied from a little bit above zero to the highest income property-rich districts in the state, up to one for the highest poverty, low property value districts in the state. Part of the reason that the match rate is that low is that this money is going to go very quickly. I mean, $100 million, which I think it may be on the high end of what's possible in this session, would go very quickly, even with these relatively low match rates. At much higher match rates, obviously, it would go even faster. The task force was quite aware of how difficult it is for many of Oregon's really small districts to pass levies, but was concerned that a match rate above one was may not have been constitutional. Once we get a ruling on that, then some more work on this would need to be done. With that, I'll answer any questions
you
may have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. Who are we waiting on that ruling on? You said we're waiting for a ruling on the constitutionality.
Well, Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, my understanding is that a number of years ago, the Department of Justice was the Treasury Department requested a ruling from the Department of Justice, but I haven't seen that ruling, and there's been a little bit of confusion recently about whether it was actually a ruling or just some advice.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't appear to have a record of any official ruling on that, and I don't know that at this point anyone has requested a ruling. Mm. The proposal from the task force, which is in Senate Bill 447, mm-hmm. Has a maximum rate of one, and so it would not, even without a ruling, it probably would pass muster.
And follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thanks for that. And did the task force come up with a report that is somewhere, or?
Mm-hmm. Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, yes, it's on the Department of Education's website. It came out, I believe, in October of last year.
What's it called, just so we can Google it?
Oh, that's a good question. If you
we'll get staff to put it in OLIS for us.
If you search on the department's main page for Capital Task Force or Capital Improvement Planning Task Force, I think it'll come up.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to send it to you if you can't find it.
Oh, there we go. Mr. Chair, I believe it's the Statewide School Facilities mm-hmm. Task Force on School Capital Improvement Planning, October 2014, final report.
Right. Correct.
Great. Good. Glad we have it. Any other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, really. The first is that it says the may establish variable ratios. And so I guess the first question is why 10 of them, or why 2 of them, or why, you know, how many of them? And then the second question is the relative ability of school districts to finance infrastructure, and how is that relative ability determined, and does that take us back to the number of ratios? I'm just curious what the thinking was in how you're going to establish your ratios, and then once you have them, what you're going to use in determining relative ability. Is there going to be rulemaking that goes back to the report that Representative Davis just referred to sort that out?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, yes, the task force made a proposal which they, I think, would describe as an example of a type of formula that could work. And as I mentioned, they used two measures. One was the poverty rate among students in the school district as a measure of need. So higher poverty, meaning a higher need. And then the other measure was assessed value in the school district per student. And in that case, assessed a higher value would mean more ability to raise money. It combined those two measures into a form of an index that was a relative measure of need using those two factors for each school district. And out of that, they calculated a ratio that could vary from 1 down to 0. So the wealthiest and highest property value districts would get a relatively low match, and districts at the opposite end of that spectrum would get a relatively high match, up to a match of 1. In other words, the state would provide a dollar for, well, viewed the other way, the state would provide a given amount of money as long as the district provided at least that much themselves.
Yes, please.
So having been involved in that Ontario bond thing, it took us 7 years. And I think there were actually 2 failed attempts before the 3rd attempt. I think much of the reason, certainly it had something to do with the low value of the real property within the district, but it also had a lot to do with the age of the population that was voting. And so I'm wondering about studies or what you have that suggest that it's all about the value of the property.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance, the task force was struggling with the notion of measuring ability to raise money or defining what a true need is. And they didn't think that those two measures, poverty plus property value, were a complete measure of that. They chose those because that data is easily available and relatively simple to understand. You know, when you get into more complex measures, they become more difficult to understand, which is, you know, in talking with the public and talking with voters is almost never a good idea. So it was a way to relatively simply get a measure that reflected ability to pay and reflected need without getting too complex.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian, how would you characterize this House bill, 3128, with the Senate bill, 447, that passed out of Senate Education? It's down in Ways and Means right now. What similarities are there? What overlaps are there? Would both of these be necessary, or could the concepts be merged into one that could accomplish what we're talking about?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I don't think the only real difference, I mean, Senate Bill 447 also proposes the bond levy itself and talks about a formula which, you know, conceptually is really consistent with the description here in this bill, that it's based on some measure of ability to raise money and some measure of need. And here we talk about, or the bill talks about, tax rates and property. Mm-hmm. It doesn't talk about the poverty rate. The reason the task force put that in there is that there's often a disconnect between the ability of the citizens to pay a higher tax rate and the amount of property value. We do have a number of, as I mentioned, school districts where the resident population is relatively mid or low income, but there's considerable amount of property value there for various reasons, commercial, second homes, even industrial property. So, you know, in reality, it's the residents who pay the bulk of an increased property tax levy, even though maybe businesses pay too, but the real burden generally falls on the residents. But the real difference between the two bills is the match ratio. The match ratio assumed in Senate Bill 447 is a maximum of 1. Here it's a maximum of 9.
Other questions? Colleagues, I would note, I've been looking at the Constitution while we've been talking. Article 11P, Section 1, Sub 3, says the proceeds from bonds issued under this section may be used only to provide matching funds to finance the capital costs of school districts that have received voter approval for local general obligation bonds and to provide for the costs of issuing bonds and the payment of debt service. So that's the sum total of what this provision talks about when it talks about matching. When you get back up to G, which was referred to, this is universities and community colleges, and it has a very specific statement about matching, which I think, if you use normal construction rules, would suggest that this is a very specific requirement, but it's quite different from the one I just read. And see if I can find it quickly. The amount of any indebtedness incurred under this section at any biennium shall be matched by an amount that is at least equal to the amount of the indebtedness. That's what it says in 11G section 1 sub 2 or 3. And so it's very different language. If I were going to argue this in a court, I would say the other language, not specifying, means any match. This language, of course, is very specific, and it says it's got to be at least equal. So, you know, the legislature could, I suppose, do a 1-to-4, 20% match if somebody else came up with the other 80% under this provision, under G. But it seems quite different. That's the only comment I had on that point. I think that this bill is pretty easy to defend, frankly, when it comes to constitutional interpretation over match rate, given that the language is quite different. I also would want to look at legislative intent. This was a measure proposed by Speaker Hunt in 2009, voted on in 2010. And in my recollection, which, of course, may be wrong, this question came up at that point, and they talked about it. It was talked about that the match rate might be different than 1-to-1. Does that provoke any question? Any other questions for this witness? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Walt Hanlon, Aaron Brown, please. And do you all four want to come up at once? That's fine. That's fine with me.
We're going to rotate it.
Pull up another chair, and we'll do it that way.
Yeah. My name's Walt Hanlon. I'm superintendent of Lowell School District. I want to thank Chairman Barnhart and the committee for the opportunity of sharing some impacts of this legislation on local small school districts. I think so often you do not hear from local small school districts because of things that, in fact, happened today. Our party ended up going from 6-to-4 because we had different issues from lockdowns to local issues. When you're the superintendent principal, in most cases we are. I happen to be semi-retired, so I'm not, so that's kind of nice. But you can't get away from your school or district to come to Salem. The proximity of Eugene and Lane County to Salem also is helpful to us. Our committee right now represents Kathleen Rodden-Nord. She's the superintendent of Junction City. Bill Watkins is on my left. He's a superintendent of Marcola School District. And behind us is Superintendent Aaron Brown from Crow Applegate on Lorain. So we're going to try to keep this brief, hopefully answer some questions you may have. But I think Kathleen will start off and give you the sense of where we are at, probably repeat some of the same information that Representative Barnhart heard when he was at the Lane ESD. And we'll go from there. Kathleen.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Barnhart and committee members. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. I will just clarify that.
And if you would state your name for the record, that would be helpful.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm Kathleen Rodden-Nord and superintendent of Junction City School District, which is kind of the big dog in the crowd here. We've got 1,700 students, and in Lane County, we are the fifth largest of 16 districts. What I hope to do this afternoon was to share a little bit with you about some demographics of districts in Lane County, the conditions of our schools, and some of the challenges we face, kind of more specific to some of what Representative Barnhart was sharing with you about the difficulties in raising revenue to fund school improvements in districts that are smaller or less affluent. And I speak from personal experience. I've lived and worked in Junction City for 20 years. This is my 13th year as superintendent. Our district last passed a bond in 1995. That bond was paid off in 2004. We've been debt-free for over 10 years now and went out for a bond in November of 2013. It represented a request of $30 million. That was about 20% of what our facilities assessment says we actually needed to urgently address. We worked hard to help our community understand our need, and ultimately we failed. Our rate of voters supporting our bond was 35%. And really what we heard from our community members was we are just too small and too poor to be able to help provide for safe and secure buildings for our children. And it's disheartening because every day we go into our schools and we see the conditions that these kids are having to try to learn in. And they include things like classrooms without windows that have heating and cooling systems that are unpredictable at best. Mm-hmm. I have an elementary school that's 65 years old. The plumbing in there is such that when my kids went through the school, I wouldn't let them drink out of the water fountain. They needed to bring their own water from home. We have roofs that leak, and we have bulletin boards in classrooms that are full of beautiful work that children have done, and their work is destroyed because of the leaks that come into their classroom. So enough about Junction City specifically. I do want to share with you that 12 of Lane County's 16 districts could be characterized as poor. We have over 50% of our students in those 12 districts that are eligible for free and reduced lunch. A number of our districts, Blatchley, South Lane, and Junction City, also serve as the largest employers in our districts. So, you know, we kind of keep the system afloat. And when we are having to spend our limited general fund dollars that are supposed to be there to educate our kids, when we're spending that on fixing leaky roofs, it's not there to buy books and have adequate class sizes. So that's a challenge we face. Many of Lane County schools were built in the 1920s and 30s, and a number of them have antiquated heating and cooling systems, failing roofs, plumbing systems, as I've described, and many of them are lacking the infrastructure to support technology that's required for assessment and good current practices and instruction. This is also very concerning. I think I share your kind of reservation with, I don't have grandchildren yet, but I'm not sure that I would want them to spend a lot of time in some of our schools. A frightening number of Lane County schools have been identified as virtually certain to collapse in the event of a major seismic event, including 100% of the schools or school in Marcola and Oak Ridge, 75% of the schools in Cottage Grove, and half of the schools in Junction City. I have four. We have concerns with respect to both the safety and security of our schools, and I'll just quickly share with you a few quotes that I obtained from my colleagues in other districts in Lane County. In Junction City, our high school has multiple buildings and wings, and we have a total of 52 exterior doors allowing entrance to our school, making it easy for a stranger to walk in onto our grounds and into our schools at any time of the day. Our antiquated communication systems and keying systems make it really hard to pull off a lockdown in the event that we do get notice that we've got an unwelcome visitor on campus. In Cayuse Law, the superintendent there reports that the high school will need asbestos abatement if and when they remodel. It has multiple points of entry that make it a safety concern, and it's at high risk of collapse should there be a major seismic event. Pleasant Hill reports that their main gymnasium is at high risk of collapse. We also, as I said a moment ago, have concerns about the conditions of our learning and working spaces. They're inefficient and they're dysfunctional. Marcola said that their elementary school is falling apart. They've got no heating system and numerous structural defects that will cost over $5 million to replace. Steam leaks in their pipes have caused water to seep into the walls and drip out of the electrical outlets. At Blatchley, their boiler system is very old. They engage in ongoing maintenance, but they still have system failures. Recently, a steam pipe fractured, and it caused major damage to the subfloor and flooring of the classroom. In the last 2 years, they've had to invest nearly $250,000 in wages, materials, and services to address just their ongoing maintenance concerns. And that's $250,000 out of a very, very small general fund budget, probably less than a couple of million dollars annually. As I mentioned before, any money that we set aside to address these maintenance issues is money that we have to take out of classrooms and away from services that we're providing to our children. Pleasant Hill says they've been forced to make tough choices between setting aside a sufficient amount of money for maintenance and staffing class sizes and programs. The more we put into maintenance, the less we have for staffing to reduce class size. In Lowell, they removed asbestos siding, asbestos flooring, upgraded their boilers, replaced roofs, insulated buildings, and had to replace every window in the building to the tune of an annual impact to their tiny budget of $150,000 a year. So you can kind of see what we're up against in trying to manage our facility needs within the confines of our regular operating budget. So that's why we go out to our communities and we ask them to help support improvements. And what we found, the stark reality is that there are tremendous disparities in the cost of a bond to different districts, depending upon size and depending on relative affluence of the community. It's kind of staggering. When I had my staff help me develop a chart and looked at the relative cost of a $20 million 20-year bond to the 16 districts in Lane County. And what we found was that $20 million bond would cost a property owner in Eugene 7 cents per thousand. It would cost a property owner in Junction City $2.25 per thousand. And it would cost a property owner, a voter, I should say. It's not just property owners that it would cost in Blatchley over $18 per thousand. So what that means is that in large urban districts like Eugene, their cost to a property owner for a $20 million 20-year bond would be less than $15 a year. And for my colleagues who live and pay taxes in Pleasant Hill and Cresswell, that would cost between $320 and $360 dollars per year for an owner of a $200,000 home. And in Crow, Oak Ridge, Lowell, Marcola, those property owners would pay over $1,000 per year for that same $20 million 20-year bond that would cost people in Eugene 15 bucks. So you can see what a difficult sell this is in small communities and what a disparity there is in terms of the impact and the ability to get our communities to support these needs. It's an equity issue. We have kids in poor districts in Oregon who deserve safe, secure, healthy learning environments, and they don't have access to them because their communities cannot afford to support them at this time. All of Oregon's children, in my opinion, deserve to be able to learn in buildings that are safe and secure, whether or not they come from a large or an affluent community. So I am hopeful that you are understanding the concerns that we're expressing today, and I want to ask you for your help and your support of Representative Barnhart's bill. And like to give my colleagues a chance to share a little bit about their stories and then see what questions you might have for us.
Right. I'd like to let them finish. Mm-hmm. We have another item that takes going to take about 20 minutes, is it, Paul? So let's take another 10 minutes now, and then we'll go on to the other item.
Sure.
So in terms of gauging our time, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Barnhart and committee members. My name is Bill Watkins. I'm the superintendent and high school principal at Marcola School District. And I have to say, I came from a state. I'm new to Oregon. This is my first year in Marcola, but I came from a state where matching funds for any district, any community that passed a bond, there was 70% matching funds for new construction and 60% matching funds for restoration of facilities as well. So coming into Oregon, I was a little bit surprised about the condition of some of the facilities our students and teachers have to be in all day, and then realizing that we really need to pass a bond to move forward. I can't keep our elementary school open much longer, and if I have to shut it down, then there's going to be portable buildings and so forth. So I've provided you all with a school facility fact sheet. Marcola is going, we're trying to pass a bond. It's on the ballot May 19th. The average age of our community is 53. There's a lot of desire to pass a bond, and they understand the need, but they also understand the huge increase in their property tax. So it's going to be a challenge to pass a bond May 19th. If it doesn't pass May 19th, we are going to have to take immediate action and finance some of the improvements that need to take place. My elementary school, as my colleague Kathleen had mentioned, the heating system, if you were to go into our elementary school, you would see it's a big Herman Nelson heater that sits outside of our school building, and we have invested in two big propane tanks, and there's a plastic tube that's connected to that Herman Nelson heater that runs down the main hallway of our elementary school. We've put holes in that plastic tube, and we have heat coming out of those holes. That's what heats our school right now. So that's got to be an initial fix next year if we do not pass that bond. With everything included on that fix, that's going to cost us probably close to $400,000 immediately. That's an equivalent of at least four teachers. And so it's a major impact on our instructional program. As Kathleen had mentioned, the property tax rates, I did a presentation to our students about bonds and giving them some more information on education finance and how our schools are financed for new construction and renovation. And I had one young man who asked me a very interesting question. I told him, I said, if we pass this bond, right now Marcola has the second lowest property tax rate in Lane County. My colleague Kathleen has the lowest, actually. And if we pass the bond, we'll be the second highest now. So the student said, well, that's great. We'll get a new school. Mr. Watkins, you mentioned things about the kinds of services that Eugene and Springfield and Bethel have. Will we get more services as well? And I had to say, no, we won't get the additional services with that. We'll get a new school, and that's it. And our property taxes will be one of the highest in Lane County. And so we're all concerned about this. We want to move forward. Our community, and I know my colleagues' communities, are really working hard to seek alternative funding, anything they can grasp a hold of to improve their facilities. I gave you a list that says, why does the district need to replace existing facilities? And what we had done, we actually brought in an engineer and an architectural firm, and they did a complete deferred maintenance plan for our school to show us what it would cost if we wanted to restore the existing building. And there's parts of that building that are over 70 years old. And just to restore that is over $5 million. And we still have, it's much like putting a lipstick on a pig. You still have the same building. It's not very safe. It's not very secure. And so the community has decided that we really need a new building, and the new building needs to be on the campus with the high school, and that's about a $7.8 million bond. The next part on that handout that you have.
If you can wrap up so that our last person gets a chance to talk, that would
yes,
be very helpful.
Yes, I will hurry up on this. In fact, I'll close actually by saying that we're trying to pass a bond for $7.8 million. That still leaves another school with maintenance costs of over $1.2 million, and that will not be addressed right now. So the last thing I just want to say, and I'll close, is there's been a lot of research on the correlation between the condition of facilities and academic outcomes. And I believe I shared this with you. If not, I'll make sure I leave it behind. It says, do school facilities affect academic outcomes? And all research that's been done on this, yes, it does, and has a direct correlation to test scores as well. One more thing, our CTE program, we this year have increased our CTE program as the state wants us to. We want to get kids their youth employability skills and connected to careers. So we've got four new programs of study. If we don't pass the bond, we will have to cut those programs. We will no longer be able to sustain it. So we're taking two steps backwards. And one step forward in this process. So thank you for your time and allowing us to share our story today.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Aaron Brown, and I'm the superintendent principal of the Crow Applegate Lorraine School District. Prior to that, I was in the Lowell School District for 7 years, so I know the plight that Walt has gone through stepping into those facilities. I do want to say, and I'm not, you've heard a lot of testimony from everybody about our aging facilities. We need help. And I'm in the process of going out for a bond at this time. We're doing our research. I can tell you one of the things that got things started in the Lowell School District was the Cool School Funds, in which we looked at energy audits. Those audits came through. We were able to help sell those to our people, and we're able to get loans and at least get things started. In my facilities, which I feel are much better than the Lowell facilities were, because my oldest building is only 50 years old. But I'm coming to the realization, in order to replace my heating system, it's going to be over $600,000 in both of my buildings. I have two buildings on my properties. So when I look at my $3 million budget, it's very difficult to get those things replaced, especially when you need to do it quickly. And I know this is cliche, but we're looking for a hand up, not a hand out. And we'd like to be able to give our best facilities for our kids in all of Lane County to keep it equitable. Thank you.
Can I take 2 seconds, 2 minutes, no more?
Well, we're out of time, but okay. I want to ask one very specific question that really has to do with this bill, and then we'll see if other members have mm-hmm. questions. And that is this. What the bill does is allow for matching funds to come from the state, assuming that the Ways and Means Committee can find the money.
Right.
would that help your bond measures become both more affordable and more likely to be approved by your voters if you were in a position where you could say to them, if we get this approved, the state will contribute X percent of the total cost, and so your dollar will go twice or three times or whatever it is as far?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I've had personal experience. I came out of California where the match was there in a poor community. There's an absolute correlation to passing a bond with the state match. It helps tremendously. It also gets a bigger bang for your buck.
Thank you. And I'm getting head nods from the others. Representative Whitsitt, did you have a question?
I just wanted to thank you for your explanation of what a $20 million bond looks like to different areas. Being from a rural area, this is what we run into. Most of our homeowners are retired and they're living on fixed incomes, and so they're looking at hundreds of dollars a year for that $20 million bond for a single school versus someone somewhere else. And the perception is that people in these rural areas basically are cheap or they don't care, and that is not it at all. It has to do with the population density and the division into the amount of bonding necessary.
Thanks. Another factor is in small districts, a lot of them throughout the state, you have forest lands and state lands that also take away tax base. Yep. So we get a compounded problem.
All right. Federal Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. That was a perfect lead-in to my question, which was, in light of the secure rural schools allocation currently, I believe, on the President's desk, which I think is $100 million for Oregon per year, so $200 million for the biennium, what effect do you think that will have on your districts, if any?
My understanding of that is it's an offset into our allocation through the state school fund formula and the general fund. So while it enhances what's available for the entire state's educational system, it doesn't have a direct impact on our schools as far as increased revenue.
And having lobbied for that out of California, that money goes into the districts individually in California. In Oregon, it goes into the state pot.
Correct.
And there's some mm-hmm. strong opinions about that in Oregon, about that in our districts.
It becomes so part of the local match.
Is it a state school fund allocation?
It becomes part of the local. It's part of the local match that is leveled off with the state school fund. So it's like property tax.
It's an offset. Yeah.
So it may end up as part of our kindergarten money you get from the state, but it's disproportionate.
Right.
Thank you.
And the school portion of that isn't not a large amount of money anyway.
No.
I think it's 20%, isn't it, of the total?
Yeah. Most of it goes to
25% of the total. Other questions? Thank you so much. And look, I really appreciate your coming today. I know it's busy and difficult. Let your colleagues know that we're sorry we didn't see some of them too, some more of them too. But I think you represented them very well. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I understand
much
the PIG
time.
Can also look a little bit better, and what these pictures show that schools are can be improved in the build in the districts too, not just torn down.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Thank you.
And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3128 and open the information meeting on OTAM.
Redoing school.
And, Paul, I left you 16 minutes you know, instead of 20.
Because it would be $100 million otherwise. So.
Okay. Hi, Mr. Chair. OTAM will not be offended.
I don't think
members of the committee, we actually were had done some work with your Senate counterparts in the Finance and Revenue Committee. They were looking at some options around major tax reform proposals and had done some simulations in a meeting with the chair and vice chairs. They said they thought, suggested that we should share this with this committee and just to kind of get an update for you in terms of where we are. I think most people know what the OTIM model is. It was created in 2001 statutorily, and we were funded for the project. We ended up with a joint effort to create OTIM with Oregon State University and Washington State University, who helped us, and we got a lot of help at that time from the California Department of Finance, who had developed the dynamic revenue analysis model, which OTIM is a cousin of. And it's a computable general equilibrium model, meaning it's a model of the entire economy. It looks at long-term economic impacts. It's not a truly dynamic model. It's what we call a comparative static model. It has a set data in it, and you shock the system with a major change in policy, and then you see where the system comes to rest. In terms of a time dimension, we generally assume that's about 5 years for a full adjustment to take place. That will vary with where you are in the business cycle. If there's a lot of excess capacity, you're in a recessed economy, it's likely to take longer for all of those adjustments to take place. But OTIM builds in, it's got 90 sectors, builds in price changes, wage changes, migration changes. So what we've done is we are in the process of updating that model now. We have put in a new data set. We've been reviewing it, and so we're kind of still in that process of fine-tuning it, bringing it up to date. And we thought we'd share a couple of just kind of base case simulations, as we call them. And these are two revenue-neutral scenarios that you have in OLIS and on the board there. The first one is, I believe that's called example one, PIT and VAT. So we've looked at the change that is frequently asked and about what would be the effects of a major reduction in personal income taxes combined with some type of consumption tax. And so what this does is, in a revenue-neutral sense, in a static sense, meaning that as we go through and do our normal calculations, this increase and decrease would offset one another in terms of estimates. And then we plug them into the system and see how the economy responds. And you can see these are just the summary statistics. We can look at individual sectors, look at how construction employment is affected or manufacturing employment down, and look at the individual sectors. But these are the totals that we have in this summary document you see. And so, for example, what we've done is we've taken our current rates of 5, 7, 9, and 9.9 and reduced them to a 4, 6, and 8%. So we now have an 8% top rate instead of a 9.9. And then we've instituted a value-added tax of 1.5%. So value-added tax is a consumption-based tax. You don't see it in the U.S. very often. The one state that has had the most experience with it is Michigan, what's called a single business tax. And that's no longer in effect. The only one that's still in effect is what's called the BET, which is the business enterprise tax in New Hampshire. And of course, New Hampshire is kind of an odd situation because they don't have income or sales taxes. So, but this would just give you a sense of how the economy would respond. If you look at the column titled change from the baseline, you can see that what personal income in the baseline would be $166.6 billion. The new equilibrium, and again, this is a shocking the system, and would show a change of about 1% in overall personal income. By the way, what we do in terms of building this into our forecast that the state economist does, this is not a forecast model. This is taking an alternative set of policies, and we would take this 1%, for example, and build that into the forecast that you have, which is the state's official forecast. And we would do, of course, the important thing is around revenue. If you look at, for example, employment in the model, and this is employment very broadly defined, self-employed are included in this, you could see that the additional jobs would be about 64,000. You also notice that population increases, this is primarily through our migration equation, so you get about a 66,000 increase in population. Notice the percentage increase in employment is greater than population. This means the labor force participation rate would increase in this scenario. Investment would increase by about $72 million. But one of the key changes that's always a little bit difficult when you first look at it is the wage index. Notice that wages fall in the simulation by almost 2%. And at first blush, that doesn't make sense for people to want to work more with lower wages. But the answer is that people respond to after-tax wages. So you've reduced the marginal tax rates. Okay. And yeah. That, the labor supply curve, you think back to your Econ 101 class, has a positive slope to it. You increase the take-home pay or the after-tax wage, you're going to get a positive response from labor supply. And, of course, with that falling wages, as labor increases, there's more demand for workers on the part of business because they're benefiting from that increased supply of labor, which means they pay a lower wage. So that drives that wage down, the gross wage down, but not the net wage, the gross wage. Capital is a complementary sector, and it responds with growth to the additional labor. And notice the price levels, which in this case decrease in spite of the value-added tax. It decreases as the lower gross wages are pushing down the price level. So the key policy variables around the revenue impact, you look at the static revenue impact, it's, as we said, we tried to make it revenue neutral as an example. The dynamic effect captures this gain in income, this $1.6 billion increase in income that you see. And that it generates a $220 million dynamic revenue effect. So what we're saying is what appears to be revenue neutral in a static sense, OTIM is saying this will generate positive revenue over time because of its impact on the economy. So again, this would be what we would assume to be a five-year period. So it would take time for that to phase in. Now, the other thing that we did, unlike the DRAM model that California designed, very similar to what we have in the top half of the block there, we put in a distribution block. And we did this through matching Department of Revenue personal income tax data and property tax data. And if you wonder what Christine did in the interim, that's what she did. She spent her time in the Department of Revenue. They got very familiar with her. And so this is a new update that we built into the OTIM. And you can see that what we did, we divide people into income groups. These, by the way, these household groups are not the same size. So some we just thought it would be easier to interpret by having these nominal breaks. So if you look at the new equilibrium, each of the household income groups benefits in terms of dollars for that group. Of course, a big part of that is because there's more people if you've got in-migration into the state. And you can see the change in number of households in the next to last column, about 28,000 more. And if you look at the mean income change per household, you can see what the dollar amounts are, with fairly evenly distributed with the exception of the high income group, and they are the major beneficiaries of that lower marginal rate. Because that marginal rate went from 9.9 to 8.0, so that's where what the state economist calls the 66ers, and that's where they're the measure 66 marginal bracket.
Right.
So that gives you one simulation. Let me say a couple of things. They said this is not a forecasting model. A couple of things it does not address. It does not address stability, because we're looking at this long-term shift. We have another tool that we call the stabilometer that allows you to address that.
The stabilometer. Have you copyrighted that term?
Or inventions, yes. So, and I know that's always a major concern around tax reform proposals. And the other thing that definitely leaves out is administration, which could be a major issue in terms of value-added tax. We spent a lot of time looking at the value-added tax in this committee back in 2001. Chair Shetterly was very interested in it at that time, and we came to the conclusion the only practical way to do that at the state level was through a sum-up method or an income method, which would have some potential administration issues and legal issues around it. And that's one of the reasons why we don't see a value-added tax at the state level in the U.S. So it doesn't show administration, but I think what it does do, it gives you a sense of some of those trade-offs, and you look at the trade-offs that may be implied from the different choices. Now, the second simulation we did, and again, these are for illustrative purposes, was another issue that we've had a lot of interest in, both before this session and now during this session, and that would be to eliminate the Schedule A deductions. So you're eliminating those itemized deductions. And then you are raising the standard deduction, but you're keeping the rates what they are. So you're going to have that current rate structure. You just have a bigger zero bracket amount through the standard deduction folks, and people lose their itemized deduction. Mm-hmm. So that's primarily middle to high income people who use those.
Yes, please.
So what do you do for people who have small businesses or farms or whatever? I mean, that can't be included in ones that lose their deductions. This is just simply those people who would normally file with, say, medical deductions or, okay.
Representative Whitson, yes, these are the Schedule A deductions, and the biggest one is mortgage interest. Yeah, that's right. About 47%. Okay. The property tax is an important one, health, medical costs over a certain threshold, charity, yeah. Charitable contribution. Yeah. So those four, but if you're a business, you're going to be able to still deduct all your expenses. So then we instituted a $100,000 homestead exemption. I think we've had a lot of interest in this notion. What it does is the homestead exemption is actually kind of similar to the standard deduction. It gives you a zero bracket amount on your property tax. So what we're saying is the first $100,000 of your assessed value of your home would be taxed at a zero rate. So you'd pay property taxes only on the value above $100,000. This would, under this proposal, it would apply to what we call UPRs, which is the owner-occupied primary residence. So it doesn't apply to rental property, doesn't apply to commercial our industrial property. So you look at the changes are fairly similar. It's again a revenue neutral in a static sense, and again you get a positive effect on the economy. The employment gains aren't quite as big. Notice you get a higher gain in population than you do in employment, meaning that you're going to get in migration, and that's because you're going to have a decrease in the cost of housing through the homestead exemption. You get investment and residential properties included in that. You do get a smaller wage decrease because you're not changing the rates. You're just changing those itemized deductions and the standard deduction. So standard deduction is able to pull more people into the labor market because those are the ones that are most affected in terms of labor force participation. For example, if you look at the 20 to 34,000 income group, they're the ones that are most responsive in our model. And they respond to these wage changes more dramatically than the other groups. So you can also see that you get a little bit more investment in the system, and you do get a modest decrease in the price level, as you did before, due to the lower gross wage. If you look at the distributional effects, they are quite a bit different than the other one. Because we're keeping those top rates in place, you actually see a reduction in the mean income for the higher income households. Let me say something about that mean income. This is a tax incidence model. So what it means is it's not just the dollars and cents taxes paid, it's the economic effects on each of these household groups, building in the wages and the income changes and how it affects their overall income level. So it's an incidence approach. But everybody else gains in terms of their mean income household. You get an increase in the number of households, and you do get a positive dynamic effect in terms of economic activity. So those are the kinds of combinations we've looked at. We're in the process of looking at some other consumption taxes. We've had a lot of interest around what Ohio calls the CAT, and we're running some simulations on that. So it's a commercial activity tax, and how that would work with some of these other policies around a homestead exemption, for example, and different types of income tax reduction proposals. Some rate of base, some based around the deductions. And of course, there's a whole myriad of things you could do around the income tax. So I will warn you that when you get into this, it could be kind of addictive.
Thank you so much. So study these very carefully. We're going to ask your questions to Dr. Warner. And with that, we'll close the information meeting, and we'll see you on Monday, I guess, isn't it?
Yes.
Monday. With that, the committee is adjourned.